Good evening. We may have to sing more than two songs to get people to come on in, but let's start with two songs. I'm glad you all are here.
Let's start with 207.
Jesus, thou art our companion.
Good evening and welcome. This evening we are going to be, besides singing about love, we're going to be discussing love some. The chapter that's for discussion this evening is 1 John 3, and Arlen suggested that I look at the love chapter, 1 Corinthians 13. So let's turn to that, and I will read it in its entirety this evening. 1 Corinthians 13. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I am become as sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not charity, I am nothing. Though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, though I give my body to be burned and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. Charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth, beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Charity never faileth, but whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know, even as also I am known. And now abideth faith, hope, and charity, these three, but the greatest of these is charity. There's not one of us that doesn't have relationships, whether it's spouse, children, parents, we all, friends, we all have relationships. And as we look at love, love is really the thing that a big thing in helping us maintain healthy relationships in our church family, in our literal family, and so on. So, I am interested to hear what Arlen has to say to us tonight about the third chapter of 1 John. So, I think we'll just go ahead and take your prayer requests. And I'm going to ask right now, I'll ask for three volunteers, three brothers that would pray aloud. We'll have a song then as we transition, and then Arlen will come and lead us in the discussion on 1 John chapter 3.
Good evening, everyone. 1 John 3, I saw two sections. We as God's children, the family of God, and the second half, God is love, so we must love one another. When you think of family, what words come to mind?
Commitment.
Security.
Belonging. Closeness.
What was that?
Closeness.
Yes.
Responsibility.
Relationship, I like that. Family has been put into place and defined by God. The Christian family, I believe, provides a picture of the wonderful relationship that we have with God. We are His children, and He is our Father. It cannot get any better than that. I don't think I've fully grasped how blessed we are to have that type of relationship with God. I mean, just think for a minute. God is a deity. He created the world, and He made a bunch of people who are free to choose to serve Him. Do you remember the illustration that Arlen used in his message on Sunday of the Greek queen, I believe it was, Orwell? In that situation, the gods, there were many of them in that situation, they were cruel, they were unjust, fickle, didn't do a whole lot for the people who served them out of fear. The book that she wrote, part of the reason that she was actually brave enough to write it was because that she had no friends or living relatives that these gods could manipulate her through. I like that contrast, that bleak picture of where Orwell was and where we are. The rich, vibrant, intimate relationship that we have with Jesus. Since we are God's children, we imitate God, right? We're supposed to. Another illustration, when my nephew Jamian was born, when Aaron and I first got to see him, of course we looked at him, see how he's designed, and we kind of inspected him and tried to figure out who he resembles, Andrea or Matthew, and as far as I can remember, he looks like Matthew a lot, the way he's built. Jamin, yeah, has lots of the same physical features and traits. When he grows older, he will have a lot of influences that will shape him into the man that he will become. I believe that one of the greatest influences will be Matthew. Why? Precisely. Matthew is Jamin's father. Matthew is very, maybe go as far as saying totally invested in Jamian's well-being, upbringing, training. He will teach Jamian many of the skills and the values that he will need and will use for the rest of his life. Since Matthew is Jamian's father, Jamian will want to be like him. Pretty soon, he's toddler, 5, 6 years old, he's going to start imitating Matthew, the way he operates. His mannerisms, way of speaking, sense of humor when he grows even older, maybe even the way he walks. All this to point to, like I said before, we are God's children, and so we're going to imitate Him. God gave us a really amazing example through Jesus, and You know, I'm sorry, that sentence really wasn't going to go anywhere. Since God is our Father, it seems only reasonable that the more time we spend with Him, the more we become like Him. And in the first couple verses of chapter 3, John spends some time affirming us as God's children. The fact that we have confidence. Read verse 2 here. Beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we should know that when He is revealed, we shall be like Him, for we shall see Him as He is. There's a section of verses 4 to 9 that can be confusing. It's talking about sin. It's talking about how sin is lawlessness. Sin is goes against the very nature of God, stuff like that. The first time I read that, I thought, if I'm in God, that means I don't sin. But I just sinned earlier this morning. Does that mean I'm not a Christian? Does that mean I'm not a child of God? I'm going to pick on Dwight here. That's Vincent right there, right? Vincent disobeys you sometimes? Okay. By the fact, like, when he disobeys you, does that mean that he is cut off, that he is no longer your son?
No.
Why?
Because he's mine.
Thank you. You love him. You punish him, you chastise him, you correct him, but he's still your son. That's never going to change. Seem to like illustrations. Remember in Matthew 18, I believe it is, the shepherd had 100 sheep, and one of the sheep decides to go off in the mountains for some reason or another, just leaves the flock. That shepherd went after his sheep. He didn't say, chalk it up to overhead. Predator probably got it. Yeah, who cares? I've got 99 more. No. He left those back in the safety of the fold, and he went out. He got that sheep. So, in the verse 6, when it says, whoever abides in him does not sin, I was wanting to get a little feedback on what you believe John was meaning by that. Are you saying that the person who is, where sin is an identifying factor in his life? Thank you.
Is stamp of God in our lives, we really don't ever become in that sense, and we don't lose our that kind of sonship, but we can lose the relationship. Do I track in at all with things that are helpful?
That was very helpful, actually. Thanks. Throughout 1 John, the writer, John, spends a lot of time encouraging the readers, us, that we are children of God, and he's assuring us of our standing with God. Another thing that was kind of confusing to me before was in chapter 1, verse 8 says, if we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. It felt to me like he was contradicting himself. But if he spent so much time encouraging us, saying that we are children of God, why would he put a couple verses in here that would tear us down? I believe we should look at verse 6 and verse 9 as an encouragement. Like Gary said, if we are in Christ, abiding in him, sin is not going to be an issue. I looked up a commentary on the internet, BibleGateway.com, and there was this paragraph that was very enlightening. I'm going to read that now. In short, the statement, "No one who is born of God will continue to sin, and others like it," ought to be heard simultaneously at several levels. First, it orients us to our future hope, a hope that as the children of God, we shall yet become more like God. Second, in directing our gaze to our future hope, the statement also assumes that the same power that will remake us at that time is already at work in us, right now. Thirdly, that power is now active in the world because it was manifested by Jesus himself in his work of breaking the grip of sin on us. And finally, in his own life, Jesus exemplified the self-giving love and obedience to God that is the responsibility of God's children as well. If some of John's statements seemed exaggerated, it is because of his eager anticipation of the blessings of the future age now being realized through the ministry of Jesus through his followers. Thanks. There's a little bunny trail that I want to hit, and I promise you I will catch the bunny. When I talked about earlier about the fear of not being God's children because we sin, there's a lie that many Christians believe. The lie is called, "I'm just a sinner saved by grace." As born-again Christians, that way of identifying ourselves is absolutely false. It's true that we once were sinners, saved by amazing grace, but now, through his sacrifice, we are saints. What that lie does, it kind of lets you justify yourself. Man, I sinned again. Well, you know, I'm just a sinner saved by grace. I was bound to mess up sooner or later. I'm going to reiterate that. We are no longer sinners, but we are saints. Now, I'm not saying that a saint can't sin. Unfortunately, we can, because we don't make the effort to keep abiding in God. There's another quote by Terry Virgo when asked if someone asked him if he sins. He said, "Sadly, in this age of conflict with the world, the flesh, and the devil, I do sin. But I sin as a saint with all the sadness and inappropriateness of it, not as a sinner with all the inevitability that that suggests." I'm going to switch to the next section. Loving each other. God is love, right? We are his children. We abide in him. We follow his example. We become more like him. So, we love. In fact, God commanded us to love. It says, I don't remember which verse it is. It says, verse 11. "For this is the message that you heard from the beginning, that we should love one another." The cool thing is that God didn't just give us an order and expect us to figure it out on our own somehow. He taught us how. How did he teach us that? Exactly, by example.
And by going near to us.
Hadn't thought of that, but yeah, that fits in very well. Jesus came down to earth, lived a completely sinless life, giving us the perfect example of love. Verse 16a, "By this we know love, because he laid down his life for us." I don't know how a better example of love is than giving yourself up for everyone. The last half of verse 16 says, "And we also ought to lay down our lives for the brethren." Would you give me a couple of practical examples of how laying down your lives for the brethren, how that looks in real life? Paul?
One small way would be to not do something that I could do myself with a good conscience, but I know if I would do it, it could cause someone else to stumble.
Is that the principle, you're saying basically the same principle of not eating meat, sacrifice to idols, in order to not offend the weaker brother? Okay. Do you think it would ever, in this day and age, it would ever come to actually sacrificing yourself for your brother? I mean, here in America, open persecution like that has not yet happened. If it would, though, do we have the relationship with each other that we would be willing to sacrifice ourselves so that our brothers could remain free?
Mm-hmm. So he
I wanted to move on to a little bit more towards relationships. I don't know if I mentioned this before, but the two halves of the chapter really fit in with each other. The family of God and loving. Verse 12, it's talking about Cain murdering his brother. Now, Cain and Abel were brothers, but Cain went completely outside of the parameters of family when he started hating his brother and then later killed him. Now, I highly doubt that there's anybody here contemplating homicide. So, in other words, I think we should apply this to relationships. Enmity within each other, towards each other, will kill. Not the flesh, but the heart, the emotions. In fact, like Jesus said, he who hates his brother is a murderer. In verse 17, but whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? Does this apply only to money? In other words, not only donating money, but donating time, as in Hands of Christ. Thank you very much, Paul, and everybody else who helps with that. Giving up preferences, that was mentioned before. Is there something in this chapter that you really would like to talk about that I haven't brought up yet? Yes, Laverne. What is the opposite of love? Hate. And if you don't love someone, in fact, if you hate someone, people with low morals would like to kill them. And it seems to me that if you're not abiding, wait, how was that? Abiding in death, it will affect the entire family. Even people who are concerned with one side, the other side, or both, whether you like it or not, it's going to affect everyone. It's going to pull you down. And until restitution is made and love is brought back, God is brought back into focus, frankly, it's gonna cause a big stink. Yes. Thanks. There is one point that I did not touch. I mentioned it slightly, was confidence. Confidence in the fact that we are God's children, as I said before. And with that relationship that we have with Jesus, in verse 22, it says, "And whatever we ask, we receive from him because we keep his commandments and do those things that are pleasing in his sight." It's another one of those simple phrases that give us the knowledge that we can talk closely with our Creator, and with the relationship we have with him, we can ask whatever. And we know that he will either say yes, no, or later. And yeah, it's very comforting. Do not marvel, my brethren, if the world hates you. Why? What do you think that is? Paul.
Just another question with that. I was hoping you'd bring that up. Verse 1. What does it mean that we're the sons of God, the children of God, the world doesn't know us?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, could you repeat that? The last part.
Just building on your question, what does this mean? It says the world knows, doesn't know us because it didn't know him. So he also asked, you know, what does that mean? What does it mean for the world to hate us? Is that the same thing as the world not knowing us? What is included in that? The world not knowing us, the world hating us?
Does anybody have any ideas? Sam. Does that mean that if non-Christians, let's just say hypothetically that we don't come across as, that we don't portray God's message in an unhealthy way. Let's say that we do it in a Christ-like manner, and people don't appreciate us, they try to tear us down. Does that mean that we're doing it right?
Seems to me that verse 12,
And then there is the flip side of the coin, when there are non-believers who are almost in everyday contact with believers, and they have a very high opinion of them, appreciate them very much. How does that happen? Paul. Did you have something, Merle? Yes. David O. Thank you. Was this Laverne? Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking about the proverb that says, when a man is away, he pleases the Lord, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him. And I think sometimes when there's conflict between belief and unbelief, we need to make sure that it wasn't some idiosyncrasy or wrong attitude or thing that caused the conflict.
Mm-hmm. Lowell again. Sorry.
Here in middle America, it's a little bit hard for us, I think, appreciate the fact that people can hate us for being Christian, but in certain parts of the world, it can be a very significant division if they decide to follow Christ and bring suppression or opposition, rather than injury that for many of them it would be a serious crossing of the line to test and disfavor the people.
Mm-hmm. Dwight. David.
Well, I think there's a universal code of ethics written on the hearts of all men. And it's true that there are men who violate those people. But as a rule, everybody wishes that everybody else would abide by those. And when they see other people doing that, like Christians ought to, I think that unless it builds conviction out of their hearts that smites them, they can actually appreciate,
because
it's part of the same that's written on their own heart.
Mm-hmm.
Harlan. This is, I'm sure, too general, but I suspect that in many cases will be appreciated by non-believers when they benefit from the relationship, but that they will start to be antagonistic toward us when our positions work against their perceived well-being.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe their comfort or whatever.
Are there anything else that you would like to say before we close? Sam. Doesn't that imply a faith in God, a faith that God is in us? That if our heart doesn't condemn us, we believe that we are right with God.
Maybe we should take verse 19 in consideration. It gives it a context of it.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to cop out again and ask if anybody has any thoughts on that.
I admit that I believe that does tell us something about 21, and this is about assurance, and that he wants us to assure our hearts before him, and if our feelings condemn us, just remember our feelings are not the best word. God is very bad.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I I want to close with this verse. This is from chapter 2, verse 28. And now, little children, abide in him, that when he appears, we may have confidence and not be ashamed before him at his coming. Do you have a song, Shane? Thank you, Shane. Let's rise for a closing prayer. Dear God, thank you so much for the assurance that we are your children, and as long as we abide in you, there is always hope. As we continue in our relationships with our family, our friends, I pray that you would always remind us of your example, of your calling, your high calling to love. I also pray that we would be a shining light to the world around us. Be with us on our way from here as we go home, and help us to always, always remember to love. In your name we pray, amen. You're dismissed.